Drawing on President George H.W. Bush's personal diaries, on the diaries of his wife, Barbara, and on extraordinary access to the 41st president and to his family, historian John Meacham has written a portrait of an intensely private man who led the nation through tumultuous times. From the Oval Office to Camp David, from his study in the private quarters of the White House to Air Force One, from the fall of the Berlin Wall to the first Gulf War to the end of communism, Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush by John Meacham, charts the thoughts, decisions, and emotions of a man who was, like the nation he led, at once noble and flawed. John Meacham received the Pulitzer Prize for his 2008 biography of Andrew Jackson, American Lion. An executive editor at Random House, he's also the author of the New York Times bestsellers Thomas Jefferson, The Art of Power, American Gospel, and Franklin and Winston. Destiny and Power is at the top of the New York Times bestseller list, and it's a great pleasure to welcome John Meacham back to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Delighted. Thank you.
What brought you to this subject?
I met President Bush for the first time 17 years ago, in 1998, and I realized almost immediately that he was a much more charismatic and interesting substantive figure than his popular image would suggest. And so my goal was to bring to life an American president who, in many ways, defies many of our conventions of great leadership. You know, we tend to honor those with trumpets and heroes on horseback and those with great eloquence. And his was a quieter, yet enormously effective style of leadership.
When you think of the leadership that is so often misread, it was misread when he campaigned for president, it was misread when he was president, it's even misread in his post-presidential years. In working on this project and looking at his diaries and the diaries of his wife and having access to the man himself, do you understand that in any way?
I think so. I think I understand why people who are accustomed to a certain kind of candidate, a certain kind of president, would have, as his son would once put it, misunderestimate him. It's not a crazy public reaction to him. But what's remarkable is that he got there. He got to the pinnacle. He was arguably the best prepared man who ever took the Oval Office. And in many ways, I think he, in the words of the French proverb, he had the vices of his virtues. He was a dignified man in a more confessional age. He was highly emotional, but did not believe that it was appropriate to show that. And so there was a kind of cascading effect where he appeared more awkward and out of tune with the times, when in fact, in private, he was very much a man who felt deeply, thought with a kind of penetration, and ultimately led us through a very tumultuous four-year period incredibly well.
As far as what we were talking about of how people reacted to him, he was aware of this. He would say that he could never quite convey his heartbeat to Americans. So he was aware of this.
Oh yeah, he knew it. And I think, you know, one of the interesting things about him is, having served 8 years as vice president with Ronald Reagan, he was dazzled and intimidated by how good at communicating Reagan was. So much so that instead of learning from him, I think with a certain kind of pridefulness, he never really tried to take full advantage of the bully pulpit, which is one of the things I hold him to account for. He actually believed, sort of sweetly and anachronistically, that if he got to the right result, if he got to the right place for the country in terms of substance, that the politics would follow, that the people would appreciate it, they would get it, they would give him credit for it. But that's just not the case. I mean, you have to sell as well as be substantive as president. And while he was perfect at the while he was excellent on the substance, he was not so good on the sell.
You write in the book about his relationship with Ronald Reagan, a man who he served as his vice president for 8 years. It was a complicated relationship, but it did evolve, didn't it?
It did. I think they formed an affectionate bond. I think Reagan respected Bush. He was as close to Bush as Reagan could be to anyone else. You know, Reagan was an interestingly solitary figure, despite his capacity to project a warm gregariousness. He really always played his cards very close to the vest, as Bush noted in his diary. He listened to Bush's counsel. Sometimes he took it, sometimes he didn't. Bush defined his vice presidency as being a senior confidential advisor without portfolio. He refused to get drawn into more public debates about the administration or about what he had told the president. So it was a perfect way for Bush to execute the vice presidency, given his essential character, which was one of discretion and dignity. But he created a big mountain for himself to climb in 88 when he wanted to take the presidency himself. And so he had to basically ask people to trust him, that he had the experience, he had the knowledge to be president, even though he wouldn't talk about the specifics of what he had advised Reagan.
There were many rumblings at the time that here was a man who is very qualified to be president, and yet it seemed to be overshadowed by at what was at that point referred to as the wimp factor.
True. And in fact, that Newsweek cover that called him, that said fighting the wimp factor, actually had the opposite effect. He became tougher after that, almost as though he wanted to show everybody that he was as he put it, stronger and tougher than the other candidates. He was a fighter. I mean, you don't get to be president of the United States by, you know, playing cricket. He was a tough campaigner. He would take positions during a campaign with which he was quite uncomfortable in order to amass power. Once he amassed it, he ultimately tried to do the right thing for the country, which I think redeems his political calculations along the way. You know, he really did believe at some level that he was the best man on the ballot and that he was destined in some degree to play a large role on the largest possible stage. A lot of people along the way in his childhood, his youth, had told him so. And so if you believe that, if you believe you're the best person, even though you might not ever say it or perhaps even admit it to yourself, then any compromise, any convenient stand you take along the way becomes not cynical, but instrumental. It's a means to an end. And I think that helps explain Bush's complicated political character.
When you talk about that complicated political character, you make the point in the book that he had such ambition when it came to run, that he would run and he would run hard. But when he was in office, he would often push aside those harsh tactics and would often take a look at what he would say is viewing that of natural interest of his own political well-being. Give us examples of that in action and how ultimately he came to understand that about himself.
Well, I'm not sure he does understand that about himself. perhaps it takes an outsider to articulate it quite this way. But there are three wonderful examples of it. One is that when he ran for the Senate from Texas in 1964, he opposed the Civil Rights Act of 64. But when he was in Congress in 1968, in the wake of Dr. King's assassination, he voted for the Fair Housing Act, which lifted racial discrimination from the real estate market. So he had, as on the campaign trail, he had taken an unadmirable position. But once he was actually in power, he voted against the will of his constituents down in Houston and voted for open housing and faced an angry meeting of those constituents. He quoted Edmund Burke saying, you know, a representative does not require, you know, does not owe his constituents simply a reflection of their will, but he owes them his judgment. The other two come from 1988. He ran a very tough, hard-hitting campaign in 88, but once he was in the White House, he tried to create a kinder, gentler political culture where they could actually get some things done. And you look back at his legislative record now, and it's a remarkable set of achievements, particularly given the standards of our own time. He passed the Clean Air Act, which is functionally our environmental policy even now. He passed the Americans with Disabilities Act, a remarkable piece of legislation. And he passed the 1990 budget deal, which established the conditions for the prosperity and fiscal discipline of the 1990s. The third example is about the 1990 deal. He had said, read my lips, no new taxes. Once he was in power, he realized the Democratic Congress was going to insist on this. He was not interested in shutting down the government and creating chaos, so he gave in on that pledge. And that led to a revolt on the right, spearheaded by Newt Gingrich, that broke Bush's base. And he knew in real time that he was doing something that might cost him a second term, but he thought it was the right thing to do. Now, did he come to see all that about himself? I mean, the closest he ever came in conversation with me was he said, politics is not a pure undertaking. Not if you want to win, it's not. Sometimes you ingest positions uncomfortably to get through a primary or get through an election. So he understood the nature of compromise and always believed, ultimately, that he could, if he got to the right result and his heart was in the right place, that that would redeem anything he had done along the way.
John Meacham is our guest. The name of the new book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. In looking at that, just that one story of no new taxes, it's one of those political stories that we hear time and time again of, oh, here's a mistake that you don't want to make again. At what point did he understand that it wasn't going to be possible and could figure out a way to communicate that to the American people that would settle with them?
Well, you know, he did it early in the morning in late June of 1990. He'd had a breakfast meeting with the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership up in the residence. He strikingly did not, after breaking the pledge for three long days, he never went out and explained why he'd done it. It's one of the great, I think, one of the great rhetorical missteps that he ever made. You know, he believed that this was part of a negotiation and that he didn't really need to do this, although in his diary he's talking about how conservatives are going crazy, how he might, he himself might be certainly in jeopardy politically. But for whatever reason, he just decided not to try to explain it clearly. And I think you can argue that the shape of our politics now, to some extent, began as a ripple effect from that particular pebble in the pond. Gingrich breaking away from Bush created a kind of freelance partisanship, helped set up the 1994 landslide against the Clinton Democrats of the era, and it created a kind of populist reaction to what was seen as establishment Republican sellout, and Bush was the most establishment Republican of all. So it's an epic moment, really, in terms of our politics even now. And what strikes me about this, and the reason I spend so much time on it in the book, obviously, is George Bush was trying to do the right thing. He was doing it as best as he could, and he expected at some level that his own party would stay with him. It was sort of beyond him in some ways to think that his party would break with him. But there they went, and I think it created a kind of, again, freelance partisanship that we're still living with today.
John Meacham's new book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. It is published by Random House.
You write, of course, about his interactions with his son and his son's presidency. Did you find he had difficulty in talking about it, or was he a proud father at some point in the conversations you had with him?
Both. He had a very hard time and said almost nothing of substance about it. And I think it's because he's a proud father. I would connect the two. he believed that anything he said in real time, and mostly in, even in retrospect, was would simply cause problems for the president. That he that this was George W.'s time; it was his turn. He had fought the good fight to win the election. He was in power, and his job, Bush 41's job, was simply to stay in the background. And one of the things that emerges from the book and the research was I do think that they talked more often about substantive matters than either one of them wanted anyone to know at the time. And George W. Bush acknowledged to me that he had probably downplayed the degree to which he asked his father's thoughts about personnel decisions, even Iraq, for fear of appearing overly dependent on the previous generation. Bush 43 acknowledged that was possibly true. President Bush 41 said to me, he said, you know, what you want to know and what you need to know, but what I'm not going to tell you is where did I agree with him and did I disagree with him? And so he told me that he was not going to tell me, basically. But the fact that he had to say that suggests that there were things he would have done differently. And he was very explicit in that he thought his son's rhetoric could be too hot at times. He singled out the phrase axis of evil as a particular example. And so, you know, it's just it's immensely complicated. I think first and foremost, the relationship is of a father and a son. It's not of a dynastic nature. It's not of a generational political nature. It's a father who knew the pressures his son was under in a way that very few other people on earth could understand them. And therefore, he just simply wasn't going to add to the son's burdens.
And yet the highlights, the headlines that came out of from the book were the president's wariness of those who surrounded his son at times and the concerns that he had of those individuals. Was he more outspoken on that?
He was. You know, he said that he thought that Dick Cheney had been allowed to have too large a role in the administration. He thought that Cheney and those around him, around the vice president, had been overly hawkish. He thought that Rumsfeld had served the president badly because of a certain swaggering tendency. But he did say, to his everlasting credit, I think, that ultimately the responsibility was Bush 43's, that his son was ultimately in charge. He said the buck stops there. And so while his criticisms of Cheney and Rumsfeld have gotten a lot of attention, and understandably, you know, he did say, but the whole thing is, you know, ends up on the desk in the Oval Office, and that's where my son was. So I think when we look back on it carefully, I think my best conclusion, my best sense, is that President Bush 41 worried that his son's rhetoric tended to overshadow his son's diplomatic achievements and his potential for more, even more diplomatic achievement. Bush 41 endorsed and ratified privately the decision to go to war in Iraq in 2003. He said, if the man won't comply, meaning Saddam, then you have to do what you have to do. He wrote his son a letter as the operation began, saying that he had made the right decision. That doesn't fit with the conventional narrative, but that's what history's for, is to actually try to pull together what really happened and not just what we think happened. So I think he was critical of Cheney, he was critical of Rumsfeld, and he was critical to some extent of his son, I think because the historical record is very important to him. You don't keep a diary two or three times a week or sometimes more as President of the United States if you don't care about history, if you don't care about the record ultimately reflecting the reality as you see it. And I think that this is as close to the world as Bush saw it as we're likely to get.
You talk about this at the end of the book, but the ground rules. You had great access, and certainly there was no editorial control, although they did get a read through, right?
They is a strong word. Some sections I gave to different people, and I did ask the president's chief of staff to read the whole thing to bring any errors of fact to my attention.
Both Bush 41 and 43 got to look at it.
No, no. Bush 41 looked at none of it. And
did he want to?
No, no. Our understanding from the beginning was that this was an independent project. I did ask 43 to look at certain sections, yes, and he did.
When it comes to the epilogue, you talk about President Obama calling President Bush to make himself available to accept the Presidential Medal of Freedom, and you say there it's difficult to imagine two more different men in terms of background, and yet President Obama having great respect for Bush 41.
Remarkably so. President Obama has thought a lot about George Herbert Walker Bush, which is sort of interesting in and of itself. I think part of it was in the first term when President Obama was having a tough time. I think he thought about, you know, great one-term presidents, you know, if in fact he became one. And if you're thinking about great one-term presidents, George H.W. Bush is right up there. But there's an enormous amount of respect and appreciation from Obama to Bush, which is remarkable on a number of levels. I mean, they're from different parties, they're from different generations. Obama ran hard against the George W. Bush years. He opposed the Iraq War. But both at that ceremony, and I think it was 2011, and then again in an interview with me, Obama was quite articulate, quite eloquent about the achievements of the Bush 41 years and the character of Bush 41 himself. And in fact, he's the one who used the phrase, the basic quotation was, "It seems to me that the best measure of a president that I know of is to what degree did a president put the country first?" And it strikes me that George H.W. Bush, as president and ever since, always tried to do that. So that's a remarkable level of appreciation across generational and partisan lines.
I love reading the section in the book about the bonding of George H.W. Bush and President Clinton.
Yeah.
When they were called into service by George W. Bush to work following the tsunami in Southeast Asia in 2004.
It's amazing. I think President Bush is perhaps as bemused by Clinton as fond as he is. He told me once, he said, "You know, Clinton talks all the time." And he said, "You know, I don't know, who knows if what he says is true? You know, he'll be talking about windmills in Nigeria." And I'm thinking, how do you know how many windmills there are in Nigeria? You know, it's impossible to fact check him. So I think there's a genuine fondness there. I think it's, on Clinton's part, I think it's, you know, here's George H.W. Bush, who's a fading embodiment of Cold War statesmanship, last president of the World War II generation. And I think Bush himself is just kind of dazzled by the Clinton show.
And Clinton enjoyed that fatherly figure.
Absolutely. That's another thing. I mean, without getting too Freudian about it, both Clinton and Obama are men who did not have fathers, stable fathers in their lives. And so there is something about this this incredibly patrician and gentlemanly father figure that is appealing to both of them.
What role do you think legacy played in President Bush wanting you to work on, in agreeing to work on this project with you? Was it to set the record straight, to have an independent account, and to try to get a story out while he's still alive?
You know, I don't think the last part. I don't think it mattered to him whether he was alive or not when the book came out. Initially, it was supposed to be a posthumous project, but obviously he's still going strong. So I went to him 3.5 years ago or so and said, mm-hmm. if it's all right, I'd like to go ahead and do this. And he was fine with that. You know, I think he's always believed that an independent view of what he did and what he tried to do would end up being, I think, if it were fair-minded, would end up being fairly positive, because he did try to serve the country as best he could, got some things right, got some things wrong, and has always thought that the historian should sort it out, as he put it. You know, he never wrote a memoir, alone among modern presidents in that. He did do a book on foreign policy with Brent Scowcroft, but that was more of a technical book than a intimate memoir. So I think that unquestionably, by agreeing to cooperate, he had some sense that this was not going to turn out badly for him, certainly. But he made no attempt at any point to spin me or wave me off the truth. I would ask him, I'd run certain theories by him. He has very little patience for large theories of life. You know, as Dan Quayle puts it, he's a results-oriented guy. And so I would offer some psychological theory about his parents, and he would sort of, you know, not really react. But that doesn't mean it's not true. It was an odd thing. You know, I've only written books about long dead people before now. So it was odd for me to be able to call up and actually ask a question. But and I'm not sure which is easier and which is harder. I'm still trying to sort that out. But unquestionably, the president had to be thinking about, you know, ultimately his historical reputation here. We're at the beginning, to be sure, we're at the beginning of this conversation. You know, it's only been 23 years since he left Washington, which is about the number, as my friend Michael Beschloss says, that's about the period, the length of time one needs to let the dust settle.
Mm-hmm.
But there'll be, you know, people are going to be writing about this family forever, not just because George H.W. Bush was a great man, but because of the son and the ongoing drama of the family. So this is just the beginning.
As we wrap up, did he talk about that idea of a political dynasty, of his of a second son possibly being president?
Yeah, no, he's very, it's very much part of the Bush code that you work for what you get. You do the Lincoln Day dinners, you do the rubber chicken circuit, you shake hands. One of my favorite anecdotes is, you know, he was working so hard in Iowa in 1980 that he shook the hand of a department store mannequin. You know, he just was just charging on. And so his view is that Jeb has to work as hard as possible, and perhaps history strikes a third time, perhaps it doesn't. He's incredibly proud of all the children, including the ones who are not in politics, and very, very attuned to what's going on. But I think attuned in a way, not like some sort of dynastic mastermind, but more like a very concerned father who loves his children, loves his son, and knows that the path this son has chosen right now is full of peril.
The name of the book is Destiny and Power, The American Odyssey of George Herbert Walker Bush. It is published by Random House. John Meacham, it's always a great pleasure to speak with you. Thank you very much for sharing with us this morning.
Great fun. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much. Again, the title of the book, Destiny and Power. John Meacham is the author. It is published by Random House. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.